We interrupt this broadcast with some important news.
Let's rewind and check out the biggest news stories from this week. It's time for Taiwan This Week.
Good evening and welcome to Taiwan This Week with me, your host Gavin Phipps. And I'm joined in the studio this evening by Brian Hugh.
Thanks for having me.
And from Taichung by Donovan Smith.
Hey, great to be here.
And we'll begin today's show with some of the latest news about last week's magnitude 7.2 earthquake. Now, President Tsai Ing-wen visited the Central Emergency Operations Center on Wednesday of this week, where she thanked search and rescue teams for their efforts and said that their actions demonstrated Taiwan's unity and strength. Tsai also said that rapid efforts are being made to restore water, telecommunications and roads still to some areas. And she also said that low-orbit satellites have been used for the first time in a disaster area in Taiwan to facilitate communications and also enhance the effectiveness of the disaster relief efforts that are ongoing. Now, the Ministry of Economic Affairs has proposed loans totaling 20 billion NT to support certain industries affected by the earthquake, while the Ministry of Health has provided over 490 million NT to assist in the recovery and reconstruction of some of the disaster areas. Meanwhile, the Taiwan Foundation for Disaster Relief says nearly 700 million NT in donations has been received to help victims of last week's earthquake, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs this week said South Korea has pledged a donation of $500,000, while Japan has announced a donation of $1 million to assist with relief efforts from the earthquake. Now, in some more figures, as of 8 a.m. on Thursday, the Central Weather Administration's Seismology Center reported that it had registered over 800 aftershocks following last Wednesday's earthquake. Now, so far, two of those aftershocks have been greater than a magnitude of 6. Nearly 20 others have ranged from magnitude 5 to 6. Over 240 other aftershocks have ranged in magnitude from between 4 and 5, and there have been nearly 600 aftershocks ranging in magnitude from between 3 and 4. But the Seismology Centre has said those figures indicate that the daily number of aftershocks is continuing to decline. Now, the National Land Management Agency this week announced that over 40 buildings suffered severe damage in last week's earthquake and have been listed as Code Red. The agency's Code Red is the highest level of damage. Now, of those buildings, over 30 are in Hualien, a couple are in Taipei, 4 are in New Taipei, and at least 4 or 5 are in Taoyuan. Now, according to the agency, over 70 buildings have now been listed as Code Yellow for secondary degree damage. That includes more than 30 in Hualien, nearly 20 in Taipei, some 7 in New Taipei, 14 in Taoyuan, and 1 in Jilung, while over 600 other buildings that don't currently fall into the colour-coded warning list are still being checked. So, Brian, it was a bit of an earthquake there we had, of course, but we don't have to linger on that. But the numbers here, I mean, over 40 buildings suffered Code Red, but apparently, you know, got private donations coming in and also donations from South Korea and Japan.
Yeah, so as with many earthquakes in the past, the buildings that were most affected were often on the East Coast due to being closer to the epicenter, but also uneven development between the capital and outside of it. And so there are more buildings that are perhaps not up to code or older in these areas. And I think we see that this time around as well. And so we have this rush by mayors in Taipei and New Taipei to call for checking buildings. There was some damage, for example, in Nanjicheng and in Wanhua, which is one of the poorer areas in Taipei. And so it reflects this kind of socioeconomic inequality in that sense. But of course, compared to 1999, 25 years ago, there was not such damage this time around. And a lot of it has been credited to the improvements in building codes since then. And the disruption to transportation infrastructure was also comparatively minimal. Some parts were cut off. There was damage to highways, to the circular line in New Taipei. But train services resumed about 1 hour after the earthquake in many cases. And while there was repair work undergoing in many places, it is quite rapid.
And what about these donations? Of course, the public has donated over 700 million NT so far in Taiwan, money from South Korea and Japan.
Yeah, that's right. And so disasters are often an occasion for diplomatic signaling, and this is no different this time around with South Korea and Japan. I mean, Japan, it's not surprising given the wave of donations from Taiwan to Japan after the 3.11 earthquake in Fukushima in 2011. And so that's another sign. It contributes a lot to goodwill from Japan towards Taiwan. So then at an earthquake in Taiwan, you do see these wave of donations.
And of course, do you think the government should accept the money or simply say thank you for the money, but, you know, we don't really need it now?
Well, I think the government come off as somewhat ungrateful for that. But then one does see shows of support from surprising places. For example, there's a rescue team dispatched from Turkey that was using drones to search for survivors and victims and so forth. And so there's that support. And the U.S., of course, is the major player when it comes to geopolitics, and U.S. Congress expressed solidarity with Taiwan after the disaster.
I did find that Turkish drone thing quite interesting because, of course, the government has been spouting on about Taiwan being a great drone developer. We've had drones used at shows here where they made flags in the sky with drones. I would have thought some local people, local rescue crews, would have been more using drones.
Well, we did have Robert Tsao say that he would fund a drone swarm of 1 million drones for his private money at some point.
But not for earthquake relief, though.
Yeah, it is interesting, actually, though, because some of the technologies that come up in this, such as drones or lower satellite images, actually have defense applications, but they also do have a role to play in managing disasters and their kind of fallout.
And Donovan?
Well, on the drones, I suppose, yes, there are dual uses for them, obviously. That Turkey sent a group here to help, that was I thought that was interesting, but of course Turkey has been very prone to disasters. And so, you know, I think for them, it helps them to prepare for their own future disasters. Locally, drones were being used. I mean, this is not like, it's not like Taiwanese were not using drones to help assist stranded communities and to do searches. So I don't really know if the Turkish group was actually very particularly helpful, but it was certainly thoughtful and welcome, and you know, I'm glad that they came. But this time around, it really seems like Taiwan was fairly self-contained. In other words, I remember after the 9/21 earthquake in 1999, we had delegations from all over the world, digging through the rubble, and over 2,000 people died. And of course, you know, I'm here in Taichung, which is pretty close to the epicenter, and Taichung was where most of the people died. Over time, what's happened is that Taiwan's response to natural disasters has definitely gotten significantly better. And I do think that there's a direct correlation between how much better it has gotten and the introduction of democracy. Because prior, when I came here in the late 80s and I lived here through the 90s, and basically disaster response was an afterthought by the government. They really didn't care because, you know, there were no consequences for them. And when it came to the construction industry, which is extremely corrupt and tied in with gangsters and all of this, and of course there was a whole bribery cycle where, you know, as long as you built something, you could put in salad oil cans and all kinds of things into the construction to cut corners to make more money. And then you'd bribe the inspectors. And, you know, there was this whole cycle of corruption and bribery. And there was no incentive to actually improve anything as long as the money was flowing. However, once democracy was introduced, then you had public officials who were directly accountable. And when and if a politician, a local leader who was elected, was perceived by the public to have been deficient in some way in a response to a natural disaster, the press would leap on them and basically roast them. And that would be a pretty traumatic experience. And then, of course, then they'd have to go to the polling booth. So, you know, starting, I think, from the late 90s, particularly after the 9/21 earthquake, public officials became a lot more accountable to the public as a result of the introduction of democracy. And so, you know, the building codes changed, the inspectors, it was not so easy to buy off the inspectors. And I think that preparedness and responsiveness to natural disasters has improved by leaps and bounds since the 90s. And I do think there's a direct connection between that and the introduction of democracy.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, particularly in the past, the government official was above the common person, but now the government answers to people. And this also coextensive with democratization. There are views then that this contributed to the rise of the Chen Shui-bian, actually, and the fall of the KMT in terms of the presidential election because of backlash in 1999 and so forth. And though I was a child then and that did not have that direct experience, I think it does echo decades later. And so even in Hualien, where there are issues of corruption that remain and frequency of the KMT is still influential there, there is this need to have accountability, for example. And so nobody wants to come off as having failed in disaster relief or contributed to these issues of corruption that are still present, because DPP and KMT will have their knives out for each other if there is mismanagement at the central level or at the local level, depending on who controls which. And so I think we do see that this time. I think also what's interesting is that there's so much more focus on Taiwan than even other earthquakes in the past decade. Certainly, it is the largest in 25 years, but there are earthquakes in 2016 and 2018 as well, and particularly very visible public images of collapsed buildings that tipped over, similar to the Uranus building this time around that became iconic of the earthquake. But in line with the focus on Taiwan in past years of geopolitical tensions or Taiwan being a source of semiconductors, it did become much more focused on. And so I have not experienced this wave of people from outside of Taiwan expressing concern about are you affected, as in those previous earthquakes, for example. And one also saw concerns about disruptions to TSMC, which then stressed that it resumed operations quite quickly. But one even sees very soft stories about the earthquake becoming international headlines, such as regarding Roger the rescue dog, who has this heartwarming story of being a former drug-sniffing dog that was too friendly, so became a rescue dog instead and helped out in this search and rescue operation, and then grabbed microphones on stage during a press conference. And that ended up being a front-page article on CNN, if I recall. And so that perhaps would have not happened even just a few years ago as well.
Meanwhile, there were questions being raised this week as to how to or even if to repair some roads and hiking trails in remote areas affected by the earthquake, with former Interior Minister Lee Hong-Yueng saying that the Highway Bureau needs to conduct a comprehensive examination to identify potential problems and fully review the costs of methods it could use to rebuild these areas. Lee also said that it's likely to take between 10 and 20 years for some areas to become stable again, and that he says that's an estimate, as he also says that terrain in the areas is already prone to landslides and heavy rainfall adds to instability. Now, according to Lee Hong-Yuen, it would take a lot of work to ensure that remote communities are not cut off from the rest of Hualien. So, Donovan, it looks like Lee Hong-Yuen saying, you know, you shouldn't, some areas maybe should be left alone to au naturel, but other areas it is important to renovate and repair.
Yes. Well, of course, the dramatically haired former Interior Minister, obviously, now he was referring to, I believe, 2013 analysis that he was going back to. So, things may have changed in some of the areas that he talked about. He also talked about, and I thought this was interesting, he said that the Executive Yuan building and the Presidential Palace, both, if there was an earthquake in Taipei, both of them were at serious risk of collapsing. So he had quite a few very, very dramatic things to say, and he also talked about if there was a similar earthquake, I believe it was 30,000 some odd buildings in Taipei would be at risk. He certainly grabbed headlines. Now, as for when he's talking about it, more remote areas, there are kind of two issues here. One is, he's right, there's a lot of infrastructure that has been built in remote areas that probably wasn't needed, was probably ill-conceived to begin with, considering the terrain and the natural disasters that Taiwan undergoes repeatedly. So he's probably right on a lot of those. On the other hand, you've got the KMT pushing to solve another problem, which is the problem of remote communities getting stranded during natural disasters. So they're pushing for Highway 6 to go from Nanto straight over to Hualien, because, as Xu Shuhua, the Nanto County Commissioner, pointed out, the Suhua Highway coming down the East Coast and the Cross Island Highway both were covered in rubble. So from the north and the west, Hualien was basically isolated. And so she wants to have Highway 6 extended from the west coast into Hualien, which she thinks would solve the problem, and that remote communities that were stranded would have a much stronger lifeline to get out or to get supplies into those communities either way. Now, on the other hand, if you build that highway, you're going to be going through some very ecologically sensitive areas, and you're going through indigenous lands, and they need to approve all of this. And as the DPP notes, this is a KMT sponsored bill, Fu Kunqi and Han Guoyu, the speaker, and Johnny Jiang, of course, have backed this bill. The DPP has complained that this would be extraordinarily expensive, and they're probably right about that. So, you know, the solutions to these problems are controversial, to say the least. But getting back to Li Hongyuan's comments, he's probably right that there are certain areas particularly within mountainous regions where typhoons, landslides, earthquakes repeatedly pummel these areas, where some of the construction, which is usually built for tourism and things like that, probably should be left to go back to, as you put it, au naturel.
Yeah, it is a challenge because there is disruption to remote communities. And we do live in an age in which there are food airdrops possible. And you can use drones, for example, to scout out areas or track changes that are caused because of disasters and see which areas are most likely to be affected. And it comes back to not only transportation, but the ability to gather information about certain places. And in an age of the internet, it's much easier. But it's interesting, too, I think, the way this has become yoked back to issues on which the DPP and KMT have fought over, such as mentioned, this kind of infrastructure proposal from the KMT. In response, the DPP has credited the low casualty rate this time around to the forward-looking infrastructure bill and tried to frame it as having not had a lot of impact on infrastructure in this way. But of course, it is often the remote communities that are lacking resources in case of disaster, whether that is, for example, COVID-19 in terms of lacking medical resources and access to that, or natural disasters such as the earthquake. And I think that is also a concern. And so that is a question, I think, in terms of local politics as it ties back to these occasional events that occur, which pose large disruption. And there's quite a lot of stakeholders here. So I think one does expect infighting, I think, politically to occur after this.
Because, of course, Brian, if they build these new roads, they can build them. Building them is okay. They can build them. Not a problem. But if there is a large earthquake or heavy rain due to a typhoon, that will cause landslides, and they'll have to be repaired over and over again, like all most of the roads in these remote areas in the Hualien area.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's, of course, the maintenance issue. And that did happen this time around, too. I mean, I think there just are roads in parts of Taiwan that will have that issue. And so if there is access to these communities, then there is that challenge. There's that as well, and also the casualty issue, in that most of the deaths that did occur, or quite a number of them, did not occur necessarily from buildings and people being trapped in them, but from falling rocks. And so the areas in which Taiwan are sensitive, whether for hiking or for travel, scouting out those areas is also something that maybe is also worth looking into. And there are signs, of course, of areas that in which there might be falling rocks, but it's also a question what happens, because usually when you're traveling, you're not prepared for this kind of thing to happen.
There's also been talk, Brian, about stopping people from going into certain areas we cut off to hikers.
Yeah, that's right, particularly now because there's a lot of disruption that still could occur. There's still movement of rocks, the things fall, there's a train derailment, I believe, that occurred because of falling rocks, or at least it was stopped for a little while. And so it's still possible that there's dangers in these areas. And I think particularly Taiwan does have a system in which you do have to register to go into certain areas. That does make finding people and knowing who is there easier. But I think it does still lead to some questions about reevaluating that, the safety practices for natural areas in Taiwan.
Donovan.
Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking, and I'm forgetting his name right now, but two Nantou County commissioners ago, he, of course, famously was convicted of corruption. And he spent, basically, they found, if memory serves, it was something like 30 million NT in cash at his house. And what he was doing is he was taking kickbacks from construction companies who were rebuilding the roads following natural disasters in Nantou County. And so, I mean, there are a lot of issues not only with repairing these roads, but also ensuring that they're done well, because these kickbacks often come at the cost of quality. In other words, you know, the construction company, they pay a kickback to get these jobs, at least in the case of two commissioners ago in Nantou, and then what they do is they take that out of the, you know, they cut corners and use, you know, what's called tofu dregs construction to do the repairs. So, you know, on top of everything that Brian mentioned, you know, there's also the issue that you have to really keep an eagle eye on, you know, are there being kickbacks being paid? And also, is the construction necessary? Is this construction, as Li Hongyuan said, there are certain types of, you know, roads and trails and things like that, a certain infrastructure that may actually not be necessary for servicing remote communities, and they serve other purposes like tourism, that really are so costly to repair and maintain that they're not worth the investment to put into them.
Moving on now, and an incoming and a former head of state battle for the headlines in local newspapers on Thursday. And we'll begin with the former one, as former President Ma Ying-jeou held talks with Xi Jinping in Beijing on Wednesday. Now, the meeting took place in the Great Hall of the People and came as Ma was wrapping up his 11-day peace tour to China. After greeting each other with an extended handshake for the courtesy of the press, Xi praised Mr. Ma for upholding the 1992 consensus, opposing Taiwan independence and promoting the peaceful development of cross-strait ties. Meanwhile, Ma thanked the Chinese side for the warm reception they'd given the student delegation that he was leading to China over the past 11 days, which he said had deepened their understanding of Chinese culture and shows that blood is thicker than water. Ma also acknowledged the recent tensions between the two sides, saying that if a cross-strait conflict were to break out, it would have unbearably heavy burdens and consequences. And he believes that Chinese people on both sides of the strait have sufficient wisdom to handle their disputes and avoid a march towards war. And speaking to reporters at Taoyuan International Airport on Thursday, after he came home from his trip to China, Ma said he firmly believes that Taiwan and China can resolve their differences, as people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait share the same culture and history. Ma said he hopes young people in Taiwan can put aside ideology and realise those historical links, as his visit is evidence that young people on either side of the strait are descendants of the Yen and Yellow Emperors and can handle disputes peacefully. Now, the KMT, of course, is defending Ma's trip and his meeting with Xi Jinping, describing Wednesday's meeting in Beijing as a breakthrough due to what it called a lack of communication and increased tensions with China under the DPP. The KMT went on to say that Ma fully demonstrated the existence of equality and mutual respect across the Taiwan Strait by mentioning the 1992 consensus as a discourse that allows respective definitions of one China by both sides. However, and you've predictably enough, the DPP has been busy downplaying the significance of the Ma-Xi meeting, saying that Ma's opinions do not reflect those of the Taiwanese public. The DPP also called on China to engage in dialogue on the basis of equality and dignity. And while praising Ma for reflecting common aspirations for peace and prosperity, the Taiwan People's Party also stressed that Ma's belief in the adherence to the 1992 consensus, it said that may not be shared by all of the public here in Taiwan, Brian.
Yeah, so it is quite interesting because there's not a lot that came policy-wise out of this because Ma is, of course, a private citizen, but one sees reinforcement of the 1990 consensus, and it's an idea the KMT cannot seem to get away from, despite Johnny Chang and Eric Chu seeming to raise the idea at times, and then Ma suddenly appearing and being very unhappy with that. He may see it as part of his political legacy, but it still does seem to be China's preferred framework for conducting relations with China. With Taiwan. And so there have been times in which there have been questions whether it would be superseded by something else. For example, meetings between Andrew Xia, the TMT deputy chair that's been dispatched to China to meet with Chinese officials multiple times since the August 2022 Pelosi visit to Taiwan. If his meeting with TCP chief ideologist Wang Huning would lead to a new formula for cross-strait relations. That did not happen. Similarly, the 2015 meeting between Ma and Xi when Ma was still president, there are questions if that would lead to a new consensus, and that also did not happen. But it is also interesting to me that the KMT has presented a united front behind Ma, saying this is a breakthrough in cross-strait relations. Because shortly before the presidential election, the KMT tried to distance itself from Ma after comments made by him in an interview with German public broadcaster Deutsche Welle, in which he called fair faith in Xi Jinping. And that did not really ring well, so he was not invited to the final rallies of the KMT. But here, the KMT has signaled support for him, and that cross-strait exchanges will continue. For example, Eric Chu stated that Sean Lian would be sent to the Straits Forum in June.
And there's also talk of Eric Chu going to China.
Yes, yet again. I mean, he also did meet with Ma in the past, and so, I'm sorry, with Xi in the past. And so it is possible that Eric Chu would go to China. I think we would have to see if that occurs.
So, Donovan, do you see a breakthrough in Beijing this week, or more of the same?
Definitely more of the same. I mean, this, you know, after, you know, Brian pointed to the DW, the Deutsche Welle interview, which happened just before the election. And, you know, I was, a reporter contacted me and was very confused about that interview. Now, it's not that during that interview that Ma said anything new, but basically what happened is during a roughly 30-minute interview, he basically managed to be within that 30 minutes, essentially a greatest hits of all of his most controversial comments. And so a lot of people overseas were very confused by that interview, and that's where he said basically, you know, Taiwan would collapse like a house of cards if China were to attack. China, you know, Taiwan and China should be reunified at some point in a few decades, and it was a very defeatist kind of interview. And of course, just a few days later, the KMT disinvited him from the final campaign rally of Hoyoi prior to the election. Now, as far as his trip to China, there was one headline in the local media that said that basically high-ranking KMT officials were breaking out into a cold sweat over it. And so because Ma Ying-jeou is fairly deep blue, and Johnny Jiang, when he was chair, and Eric Zhu, when he, you know, as chair, has tried to make the party more electable, moving away from the 92 consensus. But each time, because Ma has so much weight within the party, it's almost gravitational, I think. And, you know, so and of course, the party traditionally has always respected the party elders, and he is the ultimate party elder at this point. So what's happened is Ma has been able to continuously block changes within the KMT that would make them more electable, you know, such as dropping the 1992 consensus. But there's another element that, you know, like when I was talking to this young journalist right around the election, who was absolutely baffled by Ma's comments that seemed to be essentially selling out Taiwan, and was so down on Taiwan when the international image of Taiwan as being this plucky democracy standing up to China, and he basically, he kiboshed that from his perspective, is that I pointed out that something that people tend to forget about Ma Ying-jeou is he is Chinese. You know, he was born of Chinese parents in, they say, Hong Kong, or some people say Shenzhen, but officially in Hong Kong, while they're fleeing the Chinese Civil War. So he is actually Chinese. So when he goes to China, visits his ancestral home, and he genuinely seems to be very moved during the tomb sweeping festival to honor his ancestors, and I believe he cried last year, I think this is a completely genuine thing. I also think that his comments about, you know, the Yellow Emperor and all of these things about, and the unity of the Chinese people, I think he genuinely believes these things, but not everyone within the KMT believes that. And, you know, because the KMT is a spectrum politically, and of course the broad Taiwanese public is definitely not behind this kind of thinking. So he's definitely an outlier within Taiwan's mainstream political thinking. He's even an outlier within the KMT's thinking, but as a former president and a party elder, he continues to hold significant weight. And so Eric Zhu, of course, has to smile and put the best face on it he possibly can. But I think that the local media headline about the high-ranking officials in the party, breaking out into a cold sweat was probably accurate.
But, Brian, is it a bad thing that he goes there and talks to them?
Well, the KMT frames it as a good thing, but in the past, I think there's always a concern about KMT officials conducting direct meetings with the CCP and circumventing the elected government of Taiwan. And so the KMT is signaling the strategy will continue, or perhaps the leadership has been pushed into this strategy now. Because I think what's interesting is that this takes place in a similar time frame to Chu making moves to reduce the power of the Huang Fuxing, for example, an attempt to reduce the power of the hardliners that are very pro-unification in the KMT and to appeal to more moderate voters. And then Ma comes and does this. And I think it's interesting then that the optics of it may not also work out so well. There's a lot of lack of transparency regarding the coverage. I mean, only five Times Media outlets were allowed to cover that, and they were mostly PanBlue. The stream cuts out because security come over after like 10 minutes, which actually occurred during the MOSI meeting in Singapore in 2015 as well, after 5 minutes. And then one does wonder what this accomplishes for the KMT. The DPP framed it last time around when he went to China last year as that China had denigrated him by not actually paying him the respects that a former head of state should have. And so this time around, meeting with Xi is aimed at counteracting that narrative in some sense, but doesn't create anything new. It just really more pushes the KMT towards having to continue the strategy of engaging with China. I think what's interesting, too, is particularly the KMT has tried to frame itself as not actually being so pro-China, but also being pro-US in the past few years. And then one does see Ma doing this, and it kind of undercuts it. And the over-questioning then of US power, or the fact that the meeting was, some news reports say, was really supposed to take place on April 8th, and then it was moved to April 10th to coincide with the meeting, a summit between U.S. President Joe Biden, Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., also known as Bongbong Marcos, and Fumio Kishida of Japan, the Prime Minister. And if so, then that makes it really about geopolitics. The Office of Mining has denied that, saying that there was no meeting planned for April 8th, but that does seem like suspicious timing that it took place on the same day.
Another conspiracy theory this week, of course, was it was the 45th anniversary of the TRA when Ma was meeting with Xi.
That's also possible. It's also the day of the withdrawal from legislative REN during the Sun Farm 10 years ago, I took notice of.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a push, bro. I think all those things are a bit of a push there, Donovan. I think it was just a date for a meeting where Mr. Xi could make it.
Yeah, I think that they may have jiggered the date a little bit, maybe to coincide with the, with the Japan-U.S. summit there, possibly. Because I know that on the Chinese side, they really do actually pay a lot of attention to this kind of thing, this kind of signaling. I'm not sure that I'd go so far as to say that it was timed with the TRA and the Sunflower Movement and the U.S.-Japan summit there. I think it was probably just the U.S.-Japan summit. I think it would be a little bit of a stretch to say that it was all three. But the thing is that fundamentally the timing of Ma's trip had to do with the Tomb Sweeping Festival. And, the KMT had a trip planned to tabletop wargaming exercises by CSIS this week, and they had to deny that this was trying to counter the image of Ma being in China. And I think that they were absolutely right with Andrew Xia going to the U.S. I think that timing had nothing to do with Ma's trip. But fundamentally, Ma seems to now that it's 2 years in a row, on the Tomb Sweeping Festival, it looks like he's trying to make this an annual thing, and he wants to honor his ancestors in China and bring students over each time he does so. So I think fundamentally, I think the timing was not was fundamentally based around that, and the Chinese side may have tinkered a little bit with it to coincide with the U.S.-Japan meeting, but I don't think that we should draw giant conspiracy theories about it.
No, we certainly won't be. Anyway, as Mr. Ma was in Beijing here in Taiwan, President-elect Lai Ching-te on Wednesday announced his cabinet leadership appointments. Now, former DPP chairman Zhuo Rong-tai is set to become the next premier. Former culture minister Zhang Li-jun is going to be appointed vice premier, while current National Development Council minister Gong Ming-xin will serve as cabinet secretary general. Now, speaking to reporters after announcing his cabinet leadership appointments, Lai said that he's forming a proactive and innovative new cabinet to address challenges both at home and abroad in the face of increasing global competition. Lai also said he believes it's necessary to form a cabinet that can turn challenges into opportunities to promote Taiwan's continued progress. He described Zhuo as being the perfect choice for the premier, as he's known for his communication skills, is familiar with issues at various levels of government and legislative bodies, and also can prioritise national interests ahead of party differences. And the president-elect went on to say that he hopes the new cabinet will be able to form, and he actually said this, an active and innovative AI cabinet. Now, the KMT and the Taiwan People's Party, they have a pretty lukewarm response to the new cabinet leadership picks, with KMT Chairman Eric Ju saying the cabinet appointments will adhere to the personal will of Lai Ching-te and the DPP, and the appointments do not reflect majority public opinion in the legislative UN, while the TPP spokeswoman, Celine Wu, said the talk of innovation by Lai and Zhuo was solely aimed at attaching the AI label to something, and she went on to say the cabinet should instead spend time formulating the right policies rather than labels. Now, reports have been saying that current Foreign Minister Joseph Wu is set to return to the National Security Council when Lai Ching-te takes over. Presidential Office Secretary General and former Taichung Mayor Lin Jialong will become the next Foreign Minister. Tsai Ming-yen is expected to return to his post as the Director General of the National Security Bureau, while Wellington Gu, who currently serves as Secretary General of the National Security Council, will reportedly be appointed to the post of Defence Minister. So, Donovan, I mean, was that a surprise pick as Premier, or do you think that Mr. Zhuo was basically a good choice and probably the only one he was going to pick?
I don't think he's necessarily a very good pick from the public's perspective. He has little executive experience. I mean, he was a part of the cabinet before, you know, with the executive UN, and he was briefly party chair of the DPP. But frankly, these picks look like they're more, particularly him and Zhang Lijun, are picked because they're Lai, William Lai loyalists. That seems to be his priority over anything else. And what really kind of blew me away is with the first four announcements for the executive UN, and if you include Lai himself and Xiaobi Kim as vice president, these are the first six picks, you have three of them are New Tide, the New Tide faction. And that's pretty striking. Gong doesn't appear to have any factional affiliations. And, of course, Xiaobi Kim is considered to be part of the Ying faction. But this is pretty dramatic. And the reason I say this is if, and this is not yet 100% clear because we don't know the entire cabinet makeup, but so far it really looks like Lai is lining up his loyalists and New Tide people to be dominant, which would be a seismic shift in internal DPP politics. Because back in the, you know, the early in the 2000s, you had, you know, up to basically when Tsai Ing-wen became the party chair, the DPP factions were at each other tooth and nail. I mean, it was just bloody, horrible combat between the factions, and it played out in the media, and it was hugely embarrassing. And, you know, so what happened was is you had Tsai Ing-wen came in, and what she did is she essentially fixed what party positions, what government positions, you know, and any positions of power that were appointed by the DPP party chair, which was her, and president when she became president, on a fixed formula by faction, meaning that New Tide would get 30-40%. You'd get the Taiwan Normal Country Promotion Association, the Zhengguohui, for example, would get like 20%. The Sioux faction would get 10%. And you'd get the Ocean faction and Sunny Bank faction would get another, they get 10% each, and so on and so forth. Now, Zhuo, this is really weird, is that he co-founded a new faction in 2022, which was explicitly very pro-Lai, but was not New Tide, which is also very odd, but it's unclear if this new faction is even active. But the risks that William Lai is taking here, if he continues on this path of giving dominance to pro-Lai people, loyalists, and New Tide, he runs an internal and an external risk. The internal risk is that if he upsets the formula that Tsai had put in place to basically lock all of the factions in so that they wouldn't battle each other in public to get positions of power, If he upsets that, there's a potential for internal warfare to break out within the DPP again, which is what Tsai had done so much to clamp down on. And there are media reports in the local media saying that, that Lai is ignoring all of these rules. Now, he, by the way, was New Tide. He claims to have resigned from New Tide. I don't know how or what that means in practice. But he was widely associated as the top New Tide leader. Now, externally, this is also a big problem, because the KMT, while they generally hate the DPP, you know, just across the board, they have a particular dislike for the New Tide faction. When you get to the TPP, Kulenge and the TPP, they have kind of a muddied opinion of the DPP in public, where they credit it with some good things and some bad things in the past. Kulenge has frequently said it's not the party that it used to be, but he pins all of the blame and directs all of his ire at the New Tide faction. So if Lai is basically building the New Tide faction into the major force within the DPP and within the new government, he's basically burning bridges, especially with the TPP and Kulenge. This is, you know, so this is potentially very dangerous. Now, Wellington Gu, he served in a series of positions, and again, putting him in charge, you know, I don't know if he quite has the background to be defense minister. And when it comes to, they're talking about putting Joseph Wu at the head of the NSC, I think he would be good there, but I think he would be better if he continued as foreign minister, where he's been stellar. Putting Lin Jialong, who is the head of the Taiwan Normal Country Promotion Association faction, in as foreign minister, he is a good communicator, but I'm not sure that he has the background for that position. He was educated at Yale, so he has some overseas experience, and he is a good communicator. He does speak English, and I've met him, and he's certainly a very personable man, but I'm not sure that he has the nuance background for that particular position. I think he might be better for a different one. So I feel like if he's put into that position, that would be a sop to his faction, basically. But we'll see what happens, because those three are pure speculation at this point. The local media is reporting this, but we don't know for sure, and we can't 100% say that this is true until it is formally verified by the DPP.
Brian.
Yeah, I was quite amused by the press conference in that all of the major media outlets had live updates, and they had a list of expected candidates and if they were actually confirmed. And I remember seeing a chart, I believe it might have been on UDN, and in the end, only three are announced, the premier, vice premier, and spokesperson for the executive run.
I saw the same one.
And so it's up in the air in that sense, but it does seem that Lai has a pattern of trying to prioritize his own faction rather than party unity in that sense. But also Lai has a tendency to overplay his hand. I recall, for example, when he tried to switch out Wu Peiyi in the Wanhua Zhongzhen area of Taipei with Yili Cheng, who is closer to him, but then Wu is closer to Tsai. And that didn't really work out well. There was a backlash. And then Wu stayed. And so I also do wonder if this does actually end up backfiring on Lai in some way, where he has to revise his assessment, because he does seem to overplay his hand a little too often in that sense, particularly if Lin Jialong is the foreign minister and he ends up not having a particularly strong role or is able to inhabit that role, then it's possible that Xiaobi Kim ends up playing a very proactive role and that perhaps strengthens her hand in regards to perhaps a future presidential run. And with regards to the question of what Tsai Ing-wen does after she ends the presidency, I mean, goes back to being a factional leader, there's also those questions, I think, regarding contention within the DPP. But also, the KMT and the Panmunjom camp, including the TPP, often do leverage, as you mentioned, this history of factionalism within the DPP. See, the DPP is very prone to factions. It prioritizes the interests of factions above the public, and then both will always single out the New Tide faction. And so then I think Lai is not really helping himself here with that, preference for the new tide faction, but he does seem to prefer people that are close to him. In general, though, I think overall, in terms of the DPP, there's a lot of speculation on that the names that seem to have been more confirmed seemed originally to lack Ling Jialong and Zheng Wenzhan. And I think particularly that does reflect an issue of the DPP, is that one sees the same faces over and over again in different positions. And so there is this kind of rotating cast. That's true of both parties. But the DPP also doesn't really create an image for itself as up-and-coming or new or innovative, despite the name of this cabinet, if it just had the same faces in different roles over and over again.
But of course, the question is, Brian, is Lai Ching-te going to pick anyone from the TPP to become a cabinet minister?
Yeah, and so that's the interesting thing. I mean, probably not, but it was floated that with the divided legislature, perhaps that one would see some pan-blue picks in the cabinet, which would be a break from precedent. I think actually oftentimes, because there have been a wave of international journalists writing on Taiwan, there's some confusion regarding how cabinet appointments work or how partisanship works, in which it's very unlikely that there would be this kind of appointment of someone from another party. I even saw some articles claiming that Lai might pick premier from the KMT, which I think would be very, very unlikely. But I think that particularly an olive branch to the TPP doesn't seem in the cards at present, and this is also a sign of that.
And before we go this week, the Forestry and National Conservation Agency this week announced that it believes a good way to tackle the ongoing problem of invasive lychee giant stink bugs is for the public to simply, well, learn how to cook them and eat them. Now, the call comes as the agency has actively been trying to control the pests for many years with spraying and bounties. However, those attempts appear to have met with what officials are calling varying levels of success, and the bugs remain a problem for longan and lychee farmers. Now, the insects were apparently first spotted in Taiwan proper in 2009, and now they're a common sight during the summer months on trees in the soapberry family. Now, the bugs get their name from the corrosive, stinky liquid they release in self-defence. Now, according to the agency, lychee stink bugs are edible, a good source of protein, and members of the public can help eradicate the insects simply by eating them. Now, the Juko Nature Centre in Jai County is going to be holding classes in the coming weeks to teach people how to prepare dishes using lychee stink bugs, and on its Facebook page it has a rather delectable picture of some rather tasty looking stink bug pancakes, Brian.
Well, I think this perhaps should be inspiration for Pizza Hut Taiwan in terms of what they put on their next pizza. But the government has some weird solutions to trying to deal with invasive wildlife. I remember there's the bounties for iguanas a while ago, which led to YouTubers going and hunting iguanas with their families and slingshots and piling up the dead bodies and videos of people blowing up them with firecrackers. I don't know if people are eating iguanas, but now I think after putting bounties on stink bugs, the attempt has been to turn towards eating them. And I don't know if this approach the government would like to roll out with other wildlife, such as iguanas, but bugs in particular, that's actually a bit surprising in that sense.
They are good for you, though. Protein.
Protein, yes. And they also do cite that in some places in Southeast Asia, they are eaten and in other places around. But that is also, I don't know if the public would really get on board with this.
Donovan.
Yeah, I think Brian makes a good point about, they have to get Pizza Hut on board with this so that then Lev Nachman can eat the pizza and then get international coverage, on CNN and other international outlets, because he's become the expert on that, as far as I know. He's always the one who gets asked for quotes on that topic. I think the part that, I really don't think this is going to take off because, here's the line from, the CNA. The bugs release a corrosive, stinky liquid that can burn through leaves and fruit, which is, of course, their defense mechanism. And I kind of feel like just that line, which will be repeated and repeated and repeated in any news coverage on this topic, is going to turn some people off. I've eaten bugs before. It was either crickets or grasshoppers. And, they're crunchy. They tasted okay, but they tend to get stuck in your teeth. But these ones, a bug that releases a corrosive, stinky liquid that can burn through leaves and fruit, that kind of turns me off. And I'm not super fussy. I think most people are not super happy to eat bugs in the first place. And I think this line is pretty much, that's kind of a deal breaker for most people.
So, Donovan, yes or no, you would eat a bag of them?
No.
Brian,
that's the corrosive, stinky liquid that burns through stuff that turns me off.
Brian, I gave you a bag of nice fried stink bugs. Would you have them?
I think no, even for clout on Twitter, no.
cowards. Anyway, that's where we'll leave it here this week on Taiwan This Week. And I've been joined in the studio today by Brian Hugh.
Good night.
And from Taichung by Donovan Smith.
And great to be back.
And thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Taiwan This Week here on ICRT with me, Gavin Phipps. And don't forget to check out Taiwan This Week podcast on your favourite podcast app where you can get access to all our previous shows.
Tune in again next Friday evening at 9 for another informative look at the top stories of the week with Taiwan This Week. And don't forget to also check out our podcast on our website, icrt.com.tw. Now keep it here for more music and news only on ICRT FM 100.